Hey everyone, and welcome to The Kodakery. I'm Megan.
And I'm Josh.
Writer and director Josh Safdie joined us this week. Josh walked us through he and his brother's latest film, Good Time, from concept to screen, giving us a glimpse into the passion and intelligence that is woven into his work, which by no surprise leads to captivating, moving, raw, and honest films. He left us wanting more and itching for another Safdie film. So, let's jump into the Kodakery and talk with Josh.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Kodakery. Today in the Kodakery, Megan and I are thrilled to welcome writer-director Josh Safdie, whose latest film, Good Time, is just ripping it up, headed into award season. It's an amazing film. Megan and I both have seen it, and we are so thrilled to talk with Josh about it. Josh, thank you for joining us.
What's happening?
Well, we're gonna jump right into Good Time a little bit and talk about it. Megan and I, a little bit ago, we were able to interview the cinematographer Sean Price Williams. It was great to talk with him. We watched the film. It's an amazing piece of work. So, how does this story start for you? Where does it all begin for Good Time?
The origins and where it kind of came into reality is a strange one. I mean, every project has its own strange origins. This one, really, to be, you know, quite blunt about it, did not exist until Rob Pattinson reached out to us when we were in Texas in South by Southwest waiting on the dawn of the premiere of the Texan premiere of Heaven Knows What. And he just kind of wrote this blanket blind email saying, hey, I saw a trailer and at the time he'd only seen a still for that previous movie. And it was a close-up still of Ariel Holmes. And said, you know, it was kind of akin to the movie in a way. It was, hey, I've just seen this still from a film that you did called Heaven Knows What. I'm not quite sure, but I feel this innate connection to you guys. And because of that connection, I feel like we should kind of, you know, embark on a journey together. And it was something highfalutin and quite mystical. And I wish I could remember the exact wording, which is easy to find out. For some reason, I was actually talking with Rob the other day. He says, have you ever went back to look at even what the email really said? And I said, no, I don't know why. It's the easiest thing to do, and I just don't look at it.
I think it's better as a legend, story that morphs over time.
Right. The universe connected you guys.
Spiritual telephone. But at the time when he reached out, I was, you know, my instinct was to not even respond to the email because, I was so dead set on this other project that we've been spending, at the time it was years, and now it's more years, on trying to set up and make this movie called Uncut Gems, which we're going to be doing in the summertime of 2018. And he wasn't right for any of those roles, so I didn't really see the point of engaging. That's not how we work, and that's not how we live. So, you know, we responded and discussed the idea of meeting up and finding something to work on together. And I had this kind of lifelong attraction to a certain type of movie, but a certain type of person and a certain section of a newspaper that kind of lends itself to pulp. And I wanted to kind of go deeper with it. I wanted to make a pulp film, and I just kind of met up with Rob, and I told him I wanted to do a genre movie. But beyond that, I wanted to make a piece of pulp, a movie that kind of really investigated, the kind of the low end criminal in America, and how they are the stars of their own worlds, and kind of sidle up against him, and knowing that that would end up being a genre movie just based on the actions of that character's life. And he was into it. I mean, I approached him. I said, hey, the only thing I had when I met with him for the first time was there's a character for this film that I see being very close with Buddy Duress, maybe his brother. And there's a concept in his mind that you can only be free in this world if you own a piece of land. And it kind of stems from kind of this kind of pervasive prison philosophy, because obviously when you're in prison, you have nothing.
Right.
And also, there's a book that we always love called The Apprenticeship of Eddie Kravitz, where he thinks he could just, if he owns a piece of land, he'll be a man. So this idea that this guy had such a short-sighted dream that he just wanted to own a piece of land, and he will do anything to get that. No, and he doesn't think right past the step of owning the land. And the land could literally be, there's a joke in, I think it's Love and Death, the Woody Allen movie, where his where his, like, I think it's his father owned a piece of land, and he pulls out like literally like 1 square foot of grass, and he's like, yeah, this is my land.
This is it.
But it's kind of like that. And the original idea was it was going to be this piece of land in Ronkonkoma, Long Island, and they were going to rob a bank to do it, and they were going to rob a bank to do it by using this. They were kind of going to scam their way into an acting workshop, and they were going to use the makeup department to help, you know, disguise themselves to go rob a bank. And that was the origins of the project. At the time, I was very close with these prison journals that I had Buddy Duress keep while he was locked up, and I, you know, shared some of them with Rob, and I, you know, wanted to mine those. And there was a character in my life that I was very close with at a younger age and was close with again, and I wanted to kind of mold Connie into Connie Negus in a way.
Hmm. Were you like, Robert Pattinson just emailed us? Like, I mean, it seems like something so random and out of the blue. And at that stage in your careers, was this something that was happening a lot where you had guys reaching out to you saying, hey, we want to work with you? Or was this like completely out of the blue?
At that stage, I'm trying to think retroactively, there was a handful of, you could call them public stars, who had reached out to us, but, you know, it was a lot of kind of tertiary, kind of superficial interests, like of people saying, yeah, it would be great to do something together. But there was something about the seriousness of which Rob, you know, kind of threw himself out there, and the, you know, the, again, the spirituality of him saying, like, we must find something to work on. It's in our purpose.
Right.
Which, of course, we tried to tie into his character for Connie, the kind of desperate but also unbelievably convicted way of speaking. And we met with him, and at the end of this meeting, you know, he said, okay, let's do something together. Again, there's no script. The only thing there was a title, Good Time, and this general concept of a movie that involved a bank robbery in pursuit of this kind of shitty plot of land. And he said, you know, let's do it. And I said to him, I looked him straight in the eyes. I said, Rob, just so you know, we've entirely throughout our career, when we say we're going to do something, we do it. You know, we figure out a way to do it. And I said, with your name, we'll be able to really maneuver a way to make this a real reality. So don't bullshit us.
Right. You know, like, ready? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, we're going to leave this meeting and we're going to start and we're going to really go on a detour here, and in spite of our other bigger dream, and he was into it. So my point is that there were, yeah, I'd say, more fleeting interests than Rob that kind of engaged with us in. But at the time, you know, I also knew Rob had been very much into, you know, I'd been following his career to some degree, and seeing that he was the type of people he was working with, and the type of the type of path he was looking to travel on.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. His struggle was clearly not a commercial one. He was looking to deepen his life with the projects that mm-hmm. he wanted to work on. You know, he could have easily just set himself up in a studio system and just done romantic film after romantic film, and he didn't. You know, yeah. So that was obvious to us.
Yeah. Yeah. Very recently, before I saw Good Time, I had seen Lost City of Z, and his mm-hmm. another performance in there where he's completely transformed into another person. Like, you barely.
Oh man, his character—he's incredible in that film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I wish he was in it more.
Yeah. So to understand a little bit about your process, you've already described how where you're at this point. You know, you don't even have a script; you have a concept. How does it? I mean, how does it go from an idea to a script? I'm sure it's very complicated, but, you know, you just, like, sit around and just write like crazy. I mean, what's that?
Yeah, you know, Ronnie Bronstein, who, you know, is basically a third brother of ours at this point. You know, because we had spent so many years, you know, we met him early, like, about 12 years ago at this point, and we made a feature film together, Daddy Long Legs. And, you know, we had spent years, and I mean, he's helped refine our films in the edit stage and in his kind of brutal critique of like, you know, whatever we were trying to do. Mm-hmm. And then we started this, we had this writing process that was already at that point years into it's like kind of, I don't know, refinement stages in Uncut Gems. So we had a system in place, but we had, again, with this film, I had just a general idea and general world and characters. And I had buddies, prison journals, and I had my personal friendships with him and mm-hmm. a handful of other people, you know, that goes back to when I was 10 years old of just, you know, my own experiences as well. And that was it, really. And there was no, you know, there was no end. There was no, we had no idea how the movie was going to end. We had, you know, we didn't know if they were going to get the land or, you know, if they were going to get away. And we really just kind of set up the world and the characters and then went from there. And that was interesting because it doesn't, you know, we write in that way in kind of in a sense all the time, but this was different. This was, it was a little bit more free form in a way. But we, you know, like any project, you said, all right, who's our main character? Connie Nikas. And we started from there, and we spent probably more time developing his backstory and writing that backstory than we did writing the script. And that was, it's pretty obsessive. And some people, you know, I start showing them some of these back pages, these backstory pages, and they're flabbergasted. They're like, this is crazy. None of this stuff is in the movie. And, you know, and some of it's unbelievably interesting, and shame on us for not including them. But, you know, I believe that you feel those things.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
and
sure.
once you know these people really well, it becomes really easy to write them and know what they do in each circumstance. And that was kind of, you know, when you come from a background of, even though we're not like documentarians, but we come from a background of, you know, heaven knows what was like a docudrama basically. And, right. you know, we had been so interested in, I want to say realism, but that word is kind of so bastardized, you know, in a sense of, like, we were so interested in how people act and react and feel and think. When you take that kind of, I don't know, learned knowledge and apply it to criminal situations or, you know, thrilling situations, it really forces you to reify every single decision. And, you know, when you make a thriller, like in this day and age, people are such know-it-alls because of the, you know, the general nature of the internet and how knowledge is readily available, yeah. you know, that you have this scrutiny that you have to live by. It's like, that would never happen. That's unrealistic. Everything this day and age, like the most basic philosophical question is something real or fake? I mean, you see that all the time in YouTube comments.
Right.
So
right.
we approached each situation with that kind of, with that, you know, scrutiny and you know, something from an emotional place in terms of where someone's at in their life. And all of a sudden you can kind of walk through a narrative in a very kind of real time as from a writing approach, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's like, yep. you know, and then don't forget where we're at in America. So you can, you know, I'd say like the most interesting, the most revelatory part of the screenwriting process for us was when we got to the section in the film where Connie and the Ray character are in the amusement park in Adventureland, and the cops are literally in the park approaching them, and they're with this African immigrant unconscious on the ground, and they really had no other option. We were like, how is he gonna get out of it? Does the movie end here, or does the movie figure out what to do with Connie in police custody right now? And we really looked at all this, you know, possible outcomes, and when we realized that he could get away with it if he could just present himself as a security guard and let kind of the systemic racism in America and in the police force, not all cops are racist, but, you know, whatever, you know, in Long Island at this time of night, what have you, when we realized that he could get away with it just by presenting the situation in a very kind of matter-of-fact way, that was a weird turning point for us, because all of a sudden we were like, wait a second, you know, what's really happening here with this movie? Because it wasn't like we just wanted to set out and make this film about, you know, race, right? We were just trying to tell a pulpy story, a movie that felt, we wanted the movie to feel dangerous, but then all of a sudden in this moment, we're like, wait a second, this is totally plausible. And any kind of cutthroat audience would also go with this moment without even batting an eye. And the fact that no one would bat an eye to this plays into this kind of, you know, assumed and kind of just accepted way of life. And that's when we kind of started, we would go back and kind of approach other scenarios in the film and really take all things into consideration at any moment. So it was an interesting writing process because we would, it was almost a real-time writing process, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's like you're, it's like putting together a puzzle, but you've done your homework, and so you know what pieces there are, and then it's just like how it's like a choose-your-own-adventure, too, in a way. But
I mean, yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, I'm, when I'm, all the research I was doing for Connie, I was also doing for all the small tertiary characters, like the cops in the Nassau County Police, you know, talking to beat officers in suburban areas, talking to court officers, talking to even pizza place managers about like the craziest things that happen in their store. And, you know, you're just doing that research. You end up kind of amassing all of this strange, weird knowledge that allows you to approach every scenario with like, you know, a real like, I don't know, learned place,
yeah.
A really learned place.
So at this point, when you've got the script together, you're ready. Is this when you guys start talking about, are we going to shoot this on film? Are we going to shoot it digitally? When did that decision start to kind of come into the creative process?
Weirdly, that was kind of part of the initial concept, was we wanted to make a movie that was in this world. When I say this world, I mean this world of danger, this world of kind of lack of inhibitions, this kind of, this pulpy world, this dangerous world. We immediately wanted it to be this super pulpy presentation. We wanted it to feel like some of the films that we, you know, had grown up loving and continue to love, these movies that were presented in 35 millimeter and presented off some of the times in scope. But we wanted to approach it from an economical place. We knew the movie was a night film, so we wanted it to be, and I've had my experience with 16 millimeter in, you know, night situations, and it's, you kind of lose things quickly in low light situations. And the grain structure of 35 millimeter wanted to take advantage and really push it. So that was kind of part of the initial early concept, was how do we align this film with, you know, the trajectory and the kind of path that, you know, pulp films have had, going back to movies like even like Shakedown, or, you know, or some of the noir films, or some of the, you know, of the, you know, 50s and 60s and what have you.
So it's almost like another piece of the puzzle, really. You know, it's like another way to get the point across, I guess.
And tie your audience.
Sure. I mean, that kind of the look and the sound of the film is playing into, you know, this element of pop that we see. I mean, everything we do, we look at is, you know, you imagine the beauty of film is that it is a populist medium. You know, it even on its most avant-garde level, I mean, it's you experience it in a very kind of cavalier way. You can just like open up your eyes and watch something unfold. And because of that, you can do a lot. You know, you have a lot of room to kind of, you can sneak attack people, if that makes sense. You know, like,
right.
Because I think film is an unbelievably evil art form. I don't think it should have existed. I mean, you're going, and I'm not saying that in like a kind of, I say that very earnestly. Like,
I think
it's very, it's a fucked up medium. I don't think that we're put on this planet to recreate life the way that we do. It's like the most innate perversion that we have. We like to look at our own likeness, and we like to look at it moving, and it's voyeurism. And any level you look at it, it's voyeurism. If you put a human being in your movie, it's voyeurism. And I don't know, if you like present them, if you like kind of look at it, you're like, okay, now I'm going to take this accepted language, which is spaghetti Western or, you know, presented in CinemaScope concept of like going to the movies. You take that formal language and you mix it with, I don't know, the documentary or, you know, voyeuristic idea of like long lens photography, et cetera, and just kind of mend them all together, you can get at something I think that's kind of cool. It's like this hybrid of, you know, pure entertainment and also, you know, almost anthropology.
Yeah, it's like self-reflection as well. Yeah, there's a lot of that in there. Another tool that you have, or another puzzle piece, as I've been going along with this analogy, is music. And in Heaven Knows What, it really struck me. The music was so intense and built the intensity along the way. But I wondered how far in advance you're thinking about music as a, you know, another player in the suspense building and everything like that.
Sure. I mean, I, you know, when I first started kind of making movies, I was didn't feel like I deserved music yet. So, like, literally the first two feature films they did. The first one, there's some music in it because they, like, it's a lot in cars on a practical level, on mm-hmm. a diegetic level. There's just people listening to music. But this idea of score, like, I never felt like I could earn it. I never felt like I had earned it, or I didn't really understand how to use it. Maybe that's a better, a more humble way of describing my relationship with score. I just didn't really, I didn't earn it yet. And on Heaven Knows What, there was this kind of just loud concept underneath the lives of these characters, which is this pure romance, but like almost science fiction romance, because it was so distorted. Mm-hmm. You know, it was so it was like botulism, the romance. It was like in this can and like had no oxygen, so it like didn't have any reality checks.
Right.
And, you know, there was this music by Isao Tomita. I got to meet him before he died for the Japanese release of Heaven Knows What. He was flabbergasted that someone was using this music. You know, like Frank Sinatra said that in the Engulfed Cathedral is the music that he puts on, the Debussy piece, when he wants to be romantic with a girl. Like, he put that music on. And then he took a look at this Japanese composer's music, Tomita's renditions of Debussy, which is what we used in Heaven Knows What. He's taking literally some of the most romantic music ever made by humans, but throwing it through the most unromantic tool, which is the synthesizer.
Right.
Honestly, Tomita, he was such a pioneer of electronic music. When he bought one of the first Moog synthesizers and brought it back to Japan, he bought like one of the first seven machines.
Wow.
Brought it back to Japan. No one knew what these things were. At customs, he had these like huge, they're big machines, and Japanese customs said, "What is this?" He goes, "That's a musical instrument." And they started laughing at him. And they go, "It's a musical instrument. Make it play, and we'll let you take it into the country." And he's like, "Well, that's the thing. No one really knows how to make it play yet. I have to learn." They're like, "Okay, well, until you can prove this is a musical instrument, you can't take it from customs. We're going to hold it." So he went back and read all these manuals, and he figured, like, okay, and he came back to customs.
Come on.
And he, like, plugged the thing in. He's like, all right, I got it. And, like, he did program all this stuff, put all these kind of chords, patched all these things through, and then it just went, and literally the customs look at each other, and he goes, what was that? He goes, that's music. And they're like, get it out of here. So then he brought it back to his studio. But then, you know, the beautiful story is that, like, it had no memory, so it had to stay. Everything he programmed just keep on at all times.
Right.
And he had the guys from Yellow Magic Orchestra. Sakamoto was a part of that. You know, they would basically, he liked to work at night, so they had to keep it on all day. So they played with it all day.
Wow.
And he came in at night. Whatever. My point is that this guy, this Japanese, I call him a cosmonaut. You know, went to Buffalo, New York. I think that's where the. Somewhere near you guys in Rochester.
Yeah, I feel like that. Yeah, you're right.
And brought it back and then, like, said, I'm going to make Debussy music with this thing that sounded like an alien. So, like, that concept was so strong and, like, just felt so attuned with what was going on in Heaven Knows What.
Yeah.
That it just felt so aligned with the material. And what we saw in the final product with this, like, kind of heightened use of music, like, it really was... It was front and center. It wasn't background music. You know what I mean? It was, you know, like a choir singing, except, again, machines.
Right.
Was so interesting. The results were so, like, kind of contradictory, but at the same time so in tune with how I wanted to feel that, you know, we wanted to keep going with that. And that's how I met One on Tricks Point Never. He saw Heaven Knows What and really reacted to the use of music in the movie. And I was a fan of his. And then I kind of met with him and started talking to him about this way to use music as almost another character in the movie. And he was really into it from the get-go. And you know, there's like someone recently was telling me about this movie, The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez. Their first description of the movie is like, it's this great film. It's kind of based on a true story in the Alamo, you know, about this kind of this miscommunication between a Mexican and the sheriff, and someone got shot, and they're like, and then they say it's like beautiful and it's great performances, but it has the weirdest soundtrack. And I said, what do you mean? And they're like, it's just so strange for this southern like kind of pulpy tale. It has this weird electronic soundtrack. And I immediately was like, I got to see this thing. So, because I love the idea of that, the idea that there is this thing that people had he felt the need to tell me about it.
Right,
and it's
right.
great. It's a great, way to kind of, it was a great accompany. It was a great companion to the movie. So I don't know, the use of music is like, again, I look at the music and the lighting of the film in the exact same way. I think of them in the same exuberant light, if that makes sense.
It does. Yeah.
And it's a character. I think Connie and the music are like totally hand in hand. And, you know, we spent so much time developing that score. Like, I feel so, I love, you know, obviously music is the most popular thing in the world. And we all have a relationship with it, no matter who you are, unless you're deaf. Sorry. But even, I'm sure deaf people have a relationship with music because they see people reacting to it.
Too, yeah.
Yeah, they mm-hmm. can feel it. Mm-hmm. Music is something that we all kind of just have an innate understanding of. And I wish that I was a musician. I'm just so musically inept. I took piano lessons once, but my teacher was my neighbor in Forest Hills. And her daughter was like a virtuoso, and she would bring her to all of our sessions on my dad's Casio keyboard, and her daughter would laugh the
entire
time. That
sounds horrible.
She would just laugh at me. She was a little bit young. She was 2 years younger than me. She literally was a virtuoso. Her name was Natalie, and she would just laugh at me whenever I would have. I did like, I think, 15 lessons, and I was sidetracked. So my point
Sorry
is, I really
that.
Wish, yeah. I wish that I had that trajectory as a musician. So Daniel really enabled that within me because I was there for all of it. He even let me play the synths a couple times.
Nice. Right. Cool.
Yeah.
One of the things we wanted to ask you about was working with your brother. You guys are a duo. You're kind of co-directing the film together, but then he's also acting in the film. And his performance in Good Time is also amazing, like completely transformed into another person. Like I was honestly as blown away by his performance as I was with Robert Pattinson. Like, it's
sure.
really
mm-hmm.
great. How do you guys kind of juggle the responsibility of directing together?
Well, you know, when he's not acting, he's running boom. He's a boom operator. And he, you know, the boom operator and the sound guy, you know, they're the sound technicians. They're all overlooked, very overlooked in the hierarchy and the structure of a film set. I mean, they're, you know, the people who have literally some of the most intimate exchanges with the performers are just looked at as they're not given the respect that they deserve. And Benny really loves sound. I mean, he's a sound designer on all of our movies. He's very good at it. He's obsessed with the Terminator and that sound design. And, you know, the idea of using 25 different sounds for the effect of one, you know, basically Foley. And he really totally gets into it in that regard. He's there, the proximity. He's the boom operator. So it really, that helps us with our rapport on set and somewhat streamlining the communication to performers, et cetera. But with him as an actor was, you know, wasn't the first idea. We were originally set on casting the film with a person with real disabilities. Mm-hmm. And that can work. I've seen many films where that works really well. I actually just saw a movie at Tribeca last year. It's a film about a kid who, like, a totally entitled kid. He has autism, and he has to join some program because he did something illegal, and he's totally above everyone else in the program. It's called maybe Keep the Lights On or Shoot. I'm sorry, I can't remember it, but it's a great movie. And the entire cast they have disabilities. And actually, some of them are in Good Time totally coincidentally. And that's a movie, in terms of the scenario, that works really well with allowing performers with disabilities to kind of really heighten work and shine. This movie, because it was, and it's an action film, you know, you're doing, and action sequences are hell to go through for anyone. I mean, you're spending 2 days doing 30 seconds of the movie,
right.
and you know, one-eighth of a page. And it's not fun. It's not fun for anyone. And the repeated action and trying to stay in the mindset while you're doing the repeated action, like, it's difficult. And we didn't want to put any performers through anything that felt like we were manipulating them, you know? And that's when it kind of dawned upon us, we had to look for professionals who have, you know, do this more often. And Benny was like, you know what? I've been developing this character. He had developed this character, the character of Nick in the movie with Ronnie, for a project that fell apart in 2010. They worked on it for 7 months. Filmed all these rehearsals, and they're really captivating tapes, the edited rehearsals. And they were incredible. And Benny had this character in him. The character's name was Jordan Weissman. And he just would pull it out occasionally, and when we would do exercises and stuff and workshop with people, and he's like, I think we can turn Jordan into Nick. And that's when Ronnie and I started to take all of the work that he had done with Benny and bring it to this movie. So then we went back and kind of rewrote the script over again, not from scratch, but all the stuff with the brother.
Wow.
And brought Jordan. So what you're seeing isn't just like, you're seeing a character that's basically lived within Benny for, you know, the better part of a decade. And that character is inside Benny. He's not playing Nick. He is a part of Nick. Like, there's very much a big difference. Like, I mean, this actor asked Benny, you know, who were you modeling this character after? And he said, me. And the guy was flabbergasted when he said that, because it was disturbing to him in a weird way. But that's the truth of it. And that's why Benny, you know, is, I mean, when we were in high school, I used to see him do stand up, and he had two characters that he would do. He would show up at the club, and I would show up as like his manager, but we were teenagers, ridiculous. And, you know, but we would show up in character, and I would be like, you know, this fast talking guy is a kind of workshop, and he would be one of his characters, and they're kind of asocial people, and he would be at, you know, just sitting around and alienating the other comics. And then as he got older, he did it until he was like 24, 25. And, you know, they're great. The performances are great, but he would stay in character and it would turn them into these weird things that they're worth seeking out. One character's named Zachary Mulden, and the other one's called Ralph Handel. I prefer Zachary Mulden because he's more delusional, but Ralph Handel is something else. Ralph Handel is like a guy who works at like a publishing company who heard the concept of comedy. Stand-up comedy is like you reflect on your own life, and he doesn't really fully understand what that means. So he just gets up on stage and just asks really weird, mundane questions about his own life. Like prop comedy too. It's weird. It's really cool. They're all on YouTube. You should see them. They're really good. Yeah, and Zachary Mulden is just pure. Like he tells these stories about his own life. And it's funny because the way he tells them are just, they're kind of jokes. They're structured like jokes. Whereas Ralph Handel, you don't really get the release. Zachary Mulden, you do. You get the release. It's just so bizarre. Anyway, my point is that Benny can be in character. Like when we shot the final scene of the movie in Good Time, you know, it was very important. Like the troupe that we were working with, they were very interested in the movie we were making. They understood, you know, the complications of the film, in the sense that, you know, the movie sticks with Connie for the most part, and that it puts you in a spot because it's, you know, I think he means well. I just don't think he knows what to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that his intention of taking his brother out of this facility that he demonizes, anyone who spent time in the system hates the system. And anyone who can see the system from afar also hates the system because they realize that bureaucracy is it's such a maze of like, and the chance of actually reaching the end is difficult. Mm-hmm. So you mostly just get lost in the middle and it makes things worse. So his idea, his concept of trying to take him out and try to fix his brother or help his brother is good. He thinks you can't change the mind from the outside. You can only change it from the inside. And the only way to change it from the inside is through experience. So he thinks by giving him this induced sense of independence, which is, I think, a very interesting and smart way to kind of combat any type of mental hurdles.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a great idea. You know, obviously there are certain things you just have to accept as chemical restrictions in a weird way. But it's a great idea. The execution of the idea is very suspicious. It's like, right. You know, you didn't have to rob a bank to induce that sense of independence. Right. You know, you could, like we did this exercise to get them into character, where they took a job in a car wash, and it was Rob and Benny. And Benny was in character. Rob was in character as much as he could at that time. And they worked in a car wash. And, like, you know, it was problematic. Nick wanted to do this one thing. He didn't care about washing the cars. He just wanted to – he was obsessed with the soap pump. And he kept using this huge barrel with a big pump on it. And it became a problem because the other people in the car were like, why does this guy keep wasting soap? And Connie had to go and reprimand him, and it was a thing, but it did give him the sense of independence. Look, you can work in a car wash, right, just like everyone else. You don't need to be in a program all day. Like, you can be your own person. And again, like, but of course the movie takes that to the extreme. And he's like, look, you know, like everyone, I mean, my favorite part of the movie, one of the favorite parts of the movie is when he turns to Nick in the bank and he says, what are you thinking about? And he says, nothing.
Right.
And Connie loves that. Connie starts laughing because he's so turned on by that in a weird way, because that's Nick is free. Anyone, 99.9% of people in the middle of a bank robbery would be stealing a lot of things, that not nothing.
Right,
Their hearts would be racing. They'd be thinking about going to jail. They'd be thinking about losing their freedom. They'd be thinking about, are they going to, you know, call the cops? Are there people, is somebody noticing? Are we going to get in trouble? He literally doesn't, he's not thinking about anything in that moment. And that's free. And that's really awesome to Connie. He's like a conduit. It's like his dream in a weird way. So I don't know.
Also very, messed up.
I don't even know how
at the same time.
Totally messed up.
Yep.
Connie's a messed up guy.
Yeah.
Right. You know? But like the, in, you know,
I get it though. You know, like you can understand that side of him. It's like very simple minded.
At the end, like Dan, who did the score, he always, like when we were talking about the music and how at the end we would kind of funnel out into something that wasn't the score. But when we realized it would be this Iggy Pop collaboration, he's like, it has to be, in the weird way, it has to be like a troll on the audience in a way where it's like, you went on this whole journey with this guy, but in the end of the day, like, it's really about this guy. You know, it's really about the brother. And on a Connie level, but also on an audience level, like, you went with the sensationalist part of the story, because the other side of the story, nobody wants to pay attention to, in a weird way. So that's why we put the credits scrolling at the end, because we want to put the audience in a spot. It's like, okay, the movie's over. Formally and technically, we're telling you the movie is over. There's an end credit song. Credits are scrolling, yet arguably one of the most important scenes in the movie is unfolding underneath it.
Right.
So an audience is put in a spot. It's like, okay, I can leave. I'm saying the audience, the directors, everyone's told me, history of movie theater going has told me I can leave right now. Am I going to get up and walk out on this guy like society does every single moment? You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I think, by the way. Like,
I just sat there and
the whole movie, like, absorbed in this other kind of way. Like, and also I got to appreciate the credits, you know, that we're going over to, but it was like, damn.
No, we're not. We actually, it's also like a way to, like, not make people pay attention to the credits.
Right. Well, true. But, you know, it's like, I don't know. It was like,
I get a little bit upset when someone asks me a question. It's like, oh, you did the helicopter shot in the beginning. I was like, what the fuck? Why are you paying attention to that? Like, it's like a weird signifier. It's like, oh, you weren't paying attention to this scene.
Right.
You chose to read some of the credits.
Mm-hmm. No,
again,
I get
people
that.
Multitask.
No, I get it. No, but I did. I think it just had this nice way of, like I said, that's the only way to put it. It was like the whole movie just kind of like set, I don't know, for me. Like it, like it became like, well, I don't know why I have this.
Well, no, it like gels it together.
I was just going to say, I'm imagining like Jell-O. It's like, and okay, I get it. Yeah. All right.
Oh, well, that's good to hear.
The way that you guys, like hearing you describe the creative process and where all these parts and pieces came from, you would never ever know that from when you watch the film. Like, it seems
well,
so
well,
tight.
That's not good.
No, what I was going to say, but I think that's why we like the film so much.
No, of course.
Yeah.
What I mean is, like, the film feels so tightly put together, and, like, you went in with this very deliberate, like, I'm starting here, and I've got the story all laid out right from the beginning, where, mm-hmm. like, hearing, like, you talk about how Benny brought that character in from somewhere else and those pieces, it all gels together into this.
Well, that's great to hear, because when Sean went on this podcast... And I heard him, like, I actually stopped listening because I love Sean. I think he's such an incredible artist. He is, like, one of, honestly, he's a real rarity in the filmmaking world, because there's no insincere bone in his body.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't know how to lie for the life of him. He could never lie. And he doesn't, and that kind of flows through all the way to his eye, you know, and he's very, very talented. But he also, you know, he cut his teeth with Albert Maysles. Like, his foundation is in, you know, this weird hybrid of, like, these kind of big movies that he loves, that he keeps on his top 1,000 list. But then there's also, like, you know, these documentary films and this shooting documentary and, you know, real life and real people and this hunt for the great image. So, like, he's a great, operator. He's the most incredible operator on when it comes to designing the film. I heard him. He's like, we didn't really. The movie was 10% shot list. That's not true. The movie was 100. The movie was maybe 90.
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah,
98% shot listed. Like, there was like an obsessive amount, and I would sit there, and I went through maybe 15-20% with Sean, but like that's not
right. Well, he just didn't see that, I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
That's not. I mean, the thing is like he didn't. He, if you're gonna work with him, like you can do that, and
yeah,
that's great.
Right.
And that, and like he can, you can like we, some of the scenes that we did actually work on together are some of the best scenes in the movie. But like it's a really aggressive schedule. We averaged 13-14 hours a day. And it was really just, it was tough. It was a really tough shoot. And everyone who worked on it really, like it was everything to them. We interviewed every position was somebody who we knew, you know, on an interview level, we interviewed even the PAs, everyone we knew. And it was all, everyone was in it for the right reasons, which is very important when you build a film crew. In a weird way, there was no time for me to sit down and go through all the, so I had all the shot lists. So like, and I really, always, I've shot movies. I'm not a good operator, but I've shot movies based on necessity. Daddy Long Legs, I had to shoot because the crew was too big for these two kids who are non-actors. So I had to shoot. And it, you can tell, you know, that someone who's not the best operator is shooting this movie. You know, it was like a home movie, you know, shot on 16 millimeters. So, but Sean is a great operator. So I can sit down the day of and talk to him about this. And me and the AD and, you know, Benny, we have this very specific way we're shooting it. So when I heard him come on your show and be like, yeah, the movie wasn't shot, it's such a, that's not true.
Right.
It's not true.
You
have,
well,
and
he
I'm not saying, he's not lying. That's nah, to him, it was 20%.
Right, right. He also said that, I think he said something like the prep time for like a movie he does with you guys is like hanging out with you guys too. You know, because he
yes,
like
that's true.
Right, like
that's
he understands true. You guys so well that yeah.
Well, that's the other thing is he said he's like, you know, I only had 2 weeks prep. He had 8 weeks prep. It's just he chooses the way he uses that time.
Right.
You know,
that's
with Sean
on him.
It's like with Sean, it's such a, I mean, he is such a romantic and he's such a fatalist at the same time, which is where the great work comes from. He can, you know, see the end of the world, but he'll only see it like right before it happens, and like you know, so like he'll
yep,
you know, we'll spend time like, you know, a lot of time hanging out, and him, and a huge part of Sean is also, it's the same thing with Benny in the camp with the pole, the actors feel very comfortable around Sean. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes from his foundation with Maisel's and like him as a person. Actors feel very comfortable around him. And he knows he finds people's soul really quickly with the camera. So like I have a very intuitive sense of where to put the camera, but and he always lines up with that. He always is like, yes, I see it, let's do it. Mm-hmm. But then he'll set up the camera and he'll tweak it a tiny little bit and he'll just snap in and it'll align with the actor's soul. Mm-hmm. And it's very unique. It's like unbelievably unique. And not many camera people have that, DPs have that ability. You know, I mean, there's an antiseptic approach as well, which is interesting and appropriate. But yeah, it's you know, like you're not going to, the prep time for that, for example, is not sitting around and drawing storyboards. It's bringing Rob Pattinson around to his house and like listening to Van Morrison records and Sean doing his legendary VJ thing where he puts on all these different movies that are in his head that he thinks will align with this movie. So he's just like, literally scrubbing through, you know, 3-4 minute sections of over the course of a night, maybe 50 movies.
Wow.
And like some of them aren't even movies. Some of them are pornos and things he's found on the internet. And, you know, and like, and you're not really listening to the actual soundtracks of those movies. You're listening to like a record that he thinks is appropriate. I mean, it's a really,
yeah,
it's a really real experience. And, but in that process, you know, and then the, you know, hangout sessions before and after, he's like looking at Rob and, you know, or looking, you know, buddy he knew very well, or, you know, doing these, we did a lot of camera tests with Talia Webster who played Crystal. He's looking and he's trying to find, you know, he's always looking and trying to find the right access point to someone's beauty. And it's unique.
Right. Yeah.
But my point is like that prep time is not, that's not traditional prep time. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
I get it.
It's really, really great to kind of hear the background of how you guys assemble the stories, these films. Like, it's really fascinating. Now, you mentioned you have a production company going. You guys are working on a 16mm film now.
Correct.
What's that like for you guys as filmmakers, and kind of what led you into starting your production company?
Well, we started this, like, Alara Pictures is like a studio. It's not, it's a production company. It's also like, a studio. We're also doing a, you know, we're doing a couple of short form, like kind of certain, like movies, TV series. I guess you call them TV series. And, you know, we have a couple of other scripts. I mean, I don't know. I've always, you know, I remember when Benny and I used to go to the comic book shop and we would go, and Benny had this keen sense of feeling the cards when we'd buy the Marvel cards, and he would know which ones had the, you know, the holographic cards. And then he got so good that they put the boxes behind the counter so you couldn't feel them anymore. And we just had like an entrepreneurial bone, and we wanted to, I don't know, I always have that. I want so many things to do that I'm forced to prioritize and look at things in the right way. It makes me use my attention span in a more heightened sense. So I mm-hmm. just wanted to, I want to make a ton of stuff, you know, and like, right. I can't, and it's cool. And I want to try to help facilitate making those things. And so I read the script sent to me about a year ago by a first time filmmaker. And I don't even know if we can talk about all the logistics of it yet. But a first-time filmmaker called me and said, I want to see my script, send us the script. There was a real nugget in there. And I was like, okay, we can develop this. And then all these other parties got involved, and it turned into a bigger thing than we thought it would be. But, you know, it's interesting to see from this point of view because, you know, I'm not the director. I'm not the writer. I'm the producer, and that's strange. It's like a, you know, and because I've worked on films as art directors, as set dressers, as prop builders, and as camera people, as actors, as sound guys. I've done all the pieces. I've never really done it as a producer. And knowing, you know, like Oscar and Sibo, who produce our films, like, it's important to know when just not to speak. And it's important to know, okay, I need to just help realize this person's vision. And that's been I wanted to know how to do that. And it helps you kind of keep the muscles, you know, in tune, you know, it mm-hmm. keeps
yeah.
I hate being on set. It's something that like I fear. I don't like doing it. I don't like being in production. It's horrible. Making movies is horrible. It's a terrible experience. I mean, it is. It's like, and for a director, there's never enough time.
Okay.
Not
okay.
Sleeping. You shoot and it's grueling and you're constantly, you're like in this weird pocket, the quarterback pocket the entire time. And then you're done. And then you have to like prep for the next day. And then you just don't have enough time, and it's grueling and it's tough. And I love the challenge, but it's like, you know, it turns production into this thing you just absolutely dread. Oh no, we're going to go into production. It's never exciting. And looking at it from this point of view, it's helpful. It's kind of quelling that kind of fear of production in a,
right.
in an interesting way, because yeah. I love, you know, I love prepping for it and I love all that, but the actual production stuff is just so scary for some reason. And this is nice. It like helps look at it in a different way.
It seems like it would help even you grow as a filmmaker yourself to look at like a first time filmmaker. It's almost like that idea of teaching somebody something makes you better at it because you're being much more analytical about why you do things you do and how your creative process works in order to explain it to somebody else.
Yes, you know, that's a great point, because I found myself on the first leg of this production, you know, making suggestions when I felt like I needed to, and then having to explain why I was making the suggestion, which is, you know, when you're directing something, you don't have to explain anything. You do it. It's a dictatorship.
Right.
But all of a sudden, it's, you know, when you're like, okay, well, I think this is like, well, why do you think it should be dirty? It's like, well, the relationship between the person whose perspective it is and what he's looking at, by making it dirty, you're suggesting that there's no way that the camera on a subconscious level could get between the two objects. And like, you say these things, like, I didn't even know I could formulate that.
Right.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, all of a sudden, you're just like, it just comes out, and you're like, yeah, I guess that's...
That was an unspoken thing in the back of your head.
Right, yeah. Right.
It's weird. So, yes, it is cool. I mean, nice. Look, it's also the concept of, like, you get your foot in, and you try to make as much noise as you can, you know, because everyone knows at any moment, everything could just disappear. So, you know, I'm very fully aware of that, you know, the right. fickleness of the world and the way things work. So you just want to do things as much as possible. And, and while you have all the energy in the world. So,
and it seems like you guys are making some noise. I saw a pretty big announcement last week. I think that you've been approached to remake 48 Hours.
It wasn't like they approached. Paramount was really responded to Good Time, and you know, we had this idea for a movie, and it was similar. The concept was similar to 48 Hours, and like, we just kind of, you know, we started talking about it, and we, you know, wanted to collaborate with our friend Gerard Carmichael, and you know, it just seemed like, you know, and we coincidentally just programmed 48 Hours at Metrograph in New York, and I had a very strange approach mindset towards remakes in general. And hauntology, the theory of hauntology, and a society eating its own tail. But I think that there is this sense of like kind of Persian, whatever, or Iranian, like the Iranian films, you know, like they just took these tales and just kind of retold them. The concept of 48 Hours is broad enough. You know, we're not remaking Walter Hill's film. You can't remake someone's movie. That's ridiculous. Unless you're Mike Haneke and you're remaking your own film. That's understandable. But you can't remake a movie. But you can retell a story. You know, you can retell a general concept. I mean, 48 Hours is a very broad concept.
Yeah.
Really, really evil guy who two people, you know, who come from different parts of the world have forced to be together, you know, for 48 hours. So... yeah, it's interesting. I mean, to us, it was just an honor to have, you know, a legendary studio even want to work with us. And we had, you know, because we had been talking to a couple of other, you know, Good Time really opened up a lot of weird doors for us, the doors that we never even knew existed. So that was very exciting. And I think it attracted a certain type of attention, which we had never had any idea would do. So I'm very grateful to the film for that regard.
When I saw it, and after having seen Good Time, I was like, that's going to be awesome. Like, I can't wait to see what you guys do with it, because it just seems
the ideas we have already right now are really, really cool and exciting. And
nice.
I just want to see what we're... I just would like to see it. I want to see what we're talking about.
Yeah, right.
So that's, you know, that's... And it's cool to know that, like, wow, wait a second, we'll have the toys to do that.
Right.
So...
yeah, and that original film is so great. I mean, it's...
oh, man.
Yeah.
It's untouchable. I mean, it's the movie that, when I saw it as a kid with my dad, it was like one of those movies that was always on TV. Mm-hmm. And I'd say I probably saw it in like 1992 or something for the first time, and which is 10 years after it came out. But it was the first time I saw, growing up in New York, there's no such thing as like racism. You don't really know what that is. Mm-hmm. Especially as a kid, you don't know what that is. And... you know, when I remember asking my dad after one of the first scenes where Nick Nolte said some racist shit to Eddie Murphy's character, I remember being like, not understanding, like, why did he get so angry at him? And he's like, Nick Nolte, his character said something you just don't say to black people. And I was like, what does that mean? You know, like, it just was so foreign. Mm-hmm. But then watching the movie, he's like, it's just not, he said something really mean. And I was like, well, that's crazy to me. The idea that words could, I know words can make, as a kid, you make you feel bad, but it was just like a strange moment. And because, I had no relationship with that in our household. So but then towards the end, you realize, oh, despite these things, they realize the movie kind of exposes the absurdity of racism in its own way. You know, like these two guys, they can look past this bullshit of their backgrounds, et cetera.
Right, right.
And I remember that was really deep to me as a kid. And, this day and age is you could, I don't know, there's ways to play with that. It definitely seems like a ripe time. Those elements are going to be, they're right there. They're in the original, and they're going to be, I don't know how, what we can do in this climate that we're in now.
Right.
But it'll be... you know, it'll be there. It'll be apparent. So
yeah, yeah, and that those themes are still as relevant today as they were when that film came out. I mean,
sadly, yes.
So
if not worse,
yeah.
I think Obama was an incredible, huge step forward, but it also, like, in another where you like eight steps backwards, because it was like it like brought up all it basically mowed the lawn of America and exposed all these snakes.
Yeah.
Well said.
And also it's like, oh my God. And they're like, now they feel like because there's no credit, they can just roam around free. It's a, it's a weird place we're in right now.
It is.
Yeah. As you look forward from kind of where you guys are at right now, like you said, Good Times opening up tons of doors. You're in the midst of prepping Uncut Gems.
Yes.
You've got your next features in the. But what does success look like for you and your brother in terms of 5 years from now, 10 years from now? Like, where do you want to see your career take you?
You know, 5 years. I can kind of see 2 years. I can't even really see that. I don't know. I mean, the success to me is just living the life you want to live exactly the way you want to live it. Mm-hmm. And if that means, you know, like, for example, when we made Heaven Knows What, that was really tough because we made it for literally no money. Like, no one except the actors got paid on that movie. Like, nobody. And it was tricky, you know. It was very tough to make because everyone had to have some jobs on the side just to make that movie happen. So, like, in a hugely successful world, we can make movies like that, you know, or make movie, you know, and do it with whatever we want. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that you're not, there's no compromising happening. But then again, you know, like, I don't know if that movie looks the same if you don't have the compromises around you. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I mean, the success is basically just being able to fully investigate an interest or a path, you know, like, right. You know, you having the time and the resources to do what you want to do.
Right.
Exactly. I mean, success and time are very much linked together. And that's, you know, I want to figure that out. It would just be nice to just still be able to make movies in 5 years. So.
Right. Well, I don't think there's any danger of you guys not making movies in 5 years. And
Look, we know how to make them for nothing, so I can agree with you in that regard.
Right,
but
right.
And, you know, and I say this as I feel like looking at the work that you guys do, you're compelled to create, whether you're creating it for a studio or for yourselves, is an observation
sure.
that I would have. So I think mm-hmm. you guys are going to be making art whether no matter what. And
You got
a couple of fans here. Like, we can't wait to see what you guys do.
Thank you so much, guys. I appreciate that.
It's been a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining
us.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
It is a great satisfaction to be able to speak to you through the medium of this wonderful invention.